Now, before I reveal the subject of our next story, I'd just like to read you an extract from a BBC report earlier this year, which sets us up rather well, so bear with me. It's a scene that, with just a few changes, you might have found in the Central African bush in the late 19th century, the journalist wrote. Ploughing through the long grass is a foreigner in a wide-brimmed sun hat, scribbling away in a notebook, alongside a deferential African bearing a long pole. The two are barely able to communicate with one another. You're reminded irresistibly of images of Victorian-era explorers such as Livingstone and Stanley hacking their way across the continent. But this foreigner comes from a country that suffered from colonial exploitation itself. He's Chinese, an engineer, and his assistance pole is not for beating down the vegetation. It's a global positioning tool, taking satellite readings to plot the exact course of a road that's about to be built. Now, that incident took place, truly it did, in April this year. The pair belonged to an advanced team of surveyors deployed to the Democratic Republic of Congo by a massive state-owned firm based in Beijing, the China Railway Engineering Corporation. And the new road they're planning will be the first fruit of the biggest single deal China's ever done in Africa. It's worth $9 billion. And this deal is in fact with one of the most violent and lawless countries in all of Africa, if not the world, the Congo. Now, I think for many of us, the ongoing headlines around the Congo seem so complex, we've almost become immune to them, a bit overwhelmed by them. But our guest now is utterly intrigued by what he describes as the most tantalising and compelling place in Africa. Tim Butcher spent 4 years as the Africa correspondent for the UK's Telegraph newspaper. He's now Middle East correspondent with the Telegraph based in Jerusalem, but he's maintained a watchful eye on the Congo and has written a terrific piece in the latest Prospect magazine. So welcome to Saturday Extra, Tim.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
I take it you enjoyed that story. Did it ring true to you?
It did, and it was a perfect image, and it's happening all over the Congo because, as you say, $9 billion, that buys you quite a lot of roads and quite a lot of rail. But, I mean, isn't it an amazing echo that, you know, here we are in the 21st century basically doing something that was going on in the 19th century. And without exaggeration, what's going on in the Congo and other countries in Africa, it's basically what we call the Scramble for Africa Mark II.
That's exactly what it sounds like.
Yeah, the Scramble for Africa for the first time was when the white man basically came and stole the continent in the late 19th century and staked it as his own. And it was all started by an explorer, Henry Morton Stanley, in the Congo. That was the first sort of attempt to grab land inside. But within 20 years of that, the whole continent had been grabbed. And then we had that period of colonialism. Then we had independence. We've had a mess for 50 years. And now we've got this weird sort of strange historical echo. The Chinese are coming in, lots of money, and they're scrambling for it. And the big difference here is that the Chinese, of course, don't give a hoot who they give the money to. They don't give a hoot what the human rights are like, or the good governance is about. They simply want to get their hands on raw resources. And in the Congo, as you mentioned, possibly the most lawless, chaotic, failed state on the entire planet. You know, the money is going to the central government, but it's not going anywhere beyond. And that's where the problems come.
Actually,
people are resentful.
I'm going to come back to that just a minute, because before we just get in, I mean, you describe this as the Congo as quite literally the greatest human drama in the world. Just give us some reason about why you put it as dramatically as that.
Well, I'll tell you why, because for the last 8 years in that country, 1,500 people have died every single day. I mean, that's quite a numbing statistic if you think about it just for a second. 1,500 avoidable deaths taking place in the Congo every day because of war, because of starvation, because of chaos, because of turmoil. I mean, there isn't a single day in Taliban-infested Afghanistan when 1,500 people have died, or even in Iraq after Saddam Hussein. So, I mean, it's on a totally different quantum level in terms of suffering from anywhere else on the planet. And it goes on year in, year out, and no one basically gives a hoot.
Well, in 2004, 4 years ago now, you set out on a remarkable journey across the Congo, and reading your book Blood River, A Journey to Africa's Broken Heart, I was reminded of a very powerful lecture I heard from the BBC correspondent Michael Burke when he covered the Ethiopian famines, if you recall, and really changed a lot of our minds, I think, about in the 80s.
Yes.
And he said at the time, and I've never forgotten it, watching Ethiopia and reporting on it was like watching a country return to the Stone Age. he actually did watch people using, they'd lost their tools. They went back to sort of the tools that he had learned about. Now, I get the sense that something like that feeling descended on you when you observed the Congo.
Absolutely, and I'll tell you why. Because back in the 1950s, this is a country, the Congo, which was absolutely part of the rest of the world. It was fully integrated. If you were sick in Africa, you didn't go to South Africa, where, you know, in Johannesburg or Pretoria, you went to the Congo because they had the best tropical medicine. If you were a businessman, you went and invested in the Congo because there was a functioning economy, you got good returns. Even if you were a tourist, you went and travelled to the Congo because there were great things to see, mountain gorillas in the east, the great Congo River at Kisangani, the Ituri Forest, pygmies, Okapi. Amazing. It was fully integrated. And I know this, so it's a personal connection. My mother did this journey in the 1950s. Today, it's fallen off the map. It's totally dysfunctional.
So, in fact, you've written this great quote from you. I found I was travelling through a country with more past than future, a place where the hands of the clock spin not forwards but backwards. Now, are the people conscious of this, those who are surviving? Is there an utter demoralisation, or do you find, contrary to your expectations, life?
Well, people were aware of this, and I'll tell you why. It happened a lot. I would stop in communities in the middle of nowhere, in the bush or down on the river, and the grandparents would engage with me because they knew more about the outside world than their grandchildren. I remember riding on a motorbike, a little motorbike, because we were futzing our way through these little forest trails, and it was quite dangerous. There were rebels in the area, the same rebels who are fighting today, so you had to scuttle along. I was quite on edge. Got to this village, and earlier that day I'd seen some human skulls lying on the ground and burnt-out villages. I was pretty spooked. I got to this place, and the children, the little children, the 10-year-olds, the 12-year-olds, didn't have a clue what they were seeing. They'd never seen a motorbike. And yet their grandparents, the chief of the village, when I spoke to him round the fire, he said, oh, yeah, there used to be buses through here. I used to take a bus back in the 1950s. I mean, where else on the planet do grandchildren know less in terms of technology than their grandparents? And Geraldine, I hope it's clear from the book, the heroes of this book are those people who are trapped in the Congo who still survive, who somehow maintain dignity. And they have to put up with these rebel attacks and these incursions and these dodgy deals done by their government. And they were astonishing people for their sort of their common decency, their common integrity. But the problem, Geraldine, is that they're trapped in this vortex where they can't plan for tomorrow. They can only put all of their energies in surviving today.
Now,
it's an amazing lesson.
You seem to be saying that it's a dodgy deal that has bound China to the Congolese government, signing these multi-billion dollar deals. What resources particularly are we talking about, and why is it a dodgy deal?
Well, the Congo, it's Congo's great curse is, frankly, it basically has everything you could possibly want in terms of natural resources. It has diamonds, it has gold. Those are the kind of the big sexy headline ones. But it has copper and cobalt and cassiterite, which is the ore of tin. It has coltan, which is a rare mineral used in capacitors on your mobile phone. It has fantastic agricultural soils, great palm oil deposits, enormous rainforest. It has amazing resources. And China, as you know, in the Pacific area, you know more than anyone, they are China. The Chinese economy is screaming out for raw resources to pump into the growing economy. Mm. So they're literally the Chinese. They don't want to process anything in Africa. They don't want to add value in Africa. They just want the raw resources. So that's what they're coming for. Why is it a dodgy deal? No transparency. Absolutely none at all. We have no idea where the money's going. The government is barely a government by in any shape or form. The leader of the opposition, the leader of the democratically elected opposition in this country, they had a firefight with the government in the streets of the capital, Kinshasa, 300 or 400 people dead on the streets. It's a very, very undemocratic, unaccountable country.
And
we have no idea where the money goes. And we know this, that when the Chinese want to put in infrastructure, they're not putting it in for the people of the Congo, they're putting it in so that they can get the raw resources out. So that image that you started this piece with, that wonderful image of a track being laid out through the bush, that's not for the Congolese people. That's so they can get freight wagons in to get big bulk freight out.
But I suppose it's possible that it can achieve both things. I mean, in other words, the Chinese money, could it not broker some good things, some stability, if it was used wisely?
Okay, of course, yes, but that's the million-dollar question with not just the Congo, but with Africa, that if it was used wisely. I mean, of course it would. That would be wonderful, but there are very rare cases in Africa where money that goes into standard economic development end up developing a country. I mean, we're talking about, they had an election in the Congo 2 years ago. The UN basically paid something like $470 million to pay for this election. And $500 million of additional funding just disappeared, went missing. It's that sort of country. It's the sort of country where those sorts of sums of money, $500 million, can literally disappear. Not into any local banks. They just go overseas.
Is it your thesis that this sudden arrival of such amount of money from China, that it's actually exacerbating the pre-existing problems where there's no clear winner? By the sound of it, there's this massive vacuum in power. No one's been able to finally win and impose themselves. And this money is now making that worse. Is that really what you're saying?
I'm saying exactly that, but I'm not saying it's all doom and gloom that this is inexorable. I'm saying the arrival of this money is exacerbating existing problems that have gone on for decades. And the fighting that's going on our television screens up in the province of Kivu, that's a very old tribal animosity which is being brought alive by this very new presence of money. I'm not saying it's absolutely definite that it has to be like this, but the government in the capital city, Kinshasa, is so disconnected with the rest of the country that all sorts of local issues, local rivalries, grievances, they come up, and these people, they will fight. They will take whatever measures they can.
It's building on pre-existing ethnic tensions. I mean, it's the ethnic tensions that have got most of the headlines, and the argument that it's almost a continuation of the Rwandan war. But you're saying, no, it's more complicated than that. And I take it that you're saying there's money going into the West, which is where most of the development is occurring, but the East is where much of the violence is centred. Is that right?
Yes, but the point is, a lot of the violence in the East is because in those areas some deposits exist. That's where the coal town is, and that's where the cassiterite is. And, the weird thing, Geraldine, about the Congo is that we use the same language that we'd use for any other country. We talk about development or mines or resources. I can't try and emphasize enough how the Congo is different from anywhere I've been. I've been all over the world as a journalist. The Congo is different. There are no mines like you would think a mine with a sort of infrastructure and graders and diggers. Or a mine is literally an area where the soil has a different colour and people scrabble for it with their fingers. I've seen people do that for coltan. I've seen them do it with cobalt. It's that simple. You scrabble with fingers and you can get the ore out, see it's a different colour, put it in a bag and sell it to someone. So a mine means someone with a gun can control that hill and suddenly they're in play. And so even though the East is very, very, in terms of infrastructure, undeveloped, there's still resources there, and that's what these Rwandan-backed rebels are fighting for. And over in the West, yes, there are some deposits where some sort of development might be taking place, but development not in our... You can't drive the stuff out. You have to fly it out on dodgy Antonov aircraft because no Western planes will go in there. Mm. You have to send a little army in to defend an airstrip so that you can get your stuff out. It's that trick. It is a truly feral existence,
yes,
for the Congo.
Well, in fact, you do say this wonderful, all institutional memory, in effect, has been lost in Congo. So what's the remedy? Is there a remedy, or are we just, is it going to remain feral?
No, well, I wish there was a simple answer. Of course, there isn't a simple answer to such a sophisticated and entrenched question and entrenched problem. But I would say this. For me, money isn't the solution for the Congo. The Congo is always about, the government's always asking for more money, and Tony Blair and concerts by Geldof and things talk about debt relief. Money is not the issue in the Congo. And you can apply this across, I learned this from my experience, you can apply this across the rest of Africa. Money ain't the issue. It's lawlessness and accountability. It's the fact that the government can pinch $500 million and not be held to account for it, as it did with the election 18 months ago. It's that money will go in and nothing will percolate out into the areas. I can't describe a place which is so, I don't know anywhere else which is more lawless than the Congo. And until some sort of rule of law is established there, that's the problem. And I take a little bit of optimism, though, from one thing that's happened in the Congo, is that the International Criminal Court, you know it, of course, as the thing that was set up in The Hague, was meant to try and deal with international problems which were too difficult, which never had a remedy. The first three defendants in the ICC, where do they come from? They come from the Congo, rebel leaders from the East. And that's an interesting moment for me in Africa, because that's an African country, this government in the capital, Kinshasa, saying, we don't have the power to impose justice. We can't run a legal system in our country. We need help. And that's an important moment. It's a tiny step,
sure,
but it means that they at least acknowledge that the lawlessness, that they need to get help with justice and accountability and lawlessness.
Okay, Tim, thank you very much indeed. Tim Butcher, he's a journalist with the UK's Daily Telegraph and the author of Blood River, A Journey into Africa's Broken Heart. You can also read more of Tim's thoughts on the Congo in the December issue of Prospect magazine. And he writes as well as he speaks. Now, at, what are we, 24 minutes to nine, just time for a few more letters as promised. And I do welcome your thoughts on all the various issues, particularly debt. I meant to say at the time, I thought you might really have some, be provoked by some of Margaret Atwood's thoughts. Certainly, Anthony Clayton has been provoked by our discussion with Mr. Vitacci on creativity in Asia. He agrees, remember our guest before the news profoundly disagreed. Anthony writes, I was interested to hear your guest's view on the perceived lack of creativity in Asia when it comes to the naming of buildings and places like and such like. I'm currently living in Macau, where I've been teaching English, and this is something that my colleagues and I often discuss. In Hong Kong and Macau, we often find that students of all ages are unable to think creatively. I had many creative tasks fail dismally, and my students would even struggle to name class teams for games, coming up with things like Apple or One. All the children I know spend their free time studying or wired to their PSP or NDS Lite. There is, I presume that's Nintendo Lite, there is no time for dreaming or pondering abstract notions. Creativity is definitely expressed here in the physical form, where it has a very distinct, tangible, material value. He says, I hope it's not too much of an incoherent rant, but it just struck a chord with me when I heard those statements. Then we also had a few listeners come back with discussions about the car industry. Jeff Bolton writes, in 1997, I bought a new Holden Rodeo utility. I wanted a small utility pickup with an auto transmission. Holden was able to supply one powered by a four-cylinder 2.8-litre engine from which I got 11 years of usually reliable use at a fuel consumption of about 9 to 10 litres per 100 k's. When I was ready in 2008 to trade in for an automatic small utility pickup truck, Holden was unable to meet this need with their four-cylinder or diesel models and only able for an automatic to provide a heavier vehicle powered by a V6-cylinder 3.7-litre engine from which I get fuel consumption of 12.5 to 13 litres per 100 k's. The options buyers had in 1997 had by 2008 become severely reduced. Apart from the poorer fuel economics, the newer models also lack handy standard design features like side-lashing rails, which the earlier models had, perhaps for some cosmetic reason, question mark. This demonstrates how local subsidiaries of international car makers are unwilling to meet local client needs and are generally reinforcing use of larger vehicles with the extra fuel costs these incur. These cannot seriously claim to respond to client needs in Australia. NB, rival car makers of this kind of vehicle seem to have adopted a similar line to Holden about their utility designs, limiting customer choice and pushing buyers into fewer models and larger vehicles. And just one more on cars, Roger Keyes. Thank you for your program, which I manage to hear on most Saturdays. I'm staggered, as I think I gather a lot of ordinary people are, at the gall, or is it naivete, of the car industry from factory to sale yard in asking for handouts. For at least 30 years, it has been obvious to serious observers that we had to get over the motor car, environmentally in general and resource waste specifically. One does not have to be a space scientist to work out that carting around 100 k's of humanity by using a ton of metal and now plastic is madness. We and even government, finance ministers, treasurers and even environmental ministers know all this stuff. We know that electric cars and scooters are up and running, but we apparently don't have the nous to say to car manufacturers, produce these products and we'll help you. There must be very little research required now, surely, in order to get started. They have had decades in which to prepare for this. We have, and they have been on notice, and we've all failed to act. And just very quickly from Alicia, While appreciating your good intentions, your interview with Fiona McGregor I found highly offensive as an Australian of Polish background. That was Fiona McGregor, who went to Poland and did a very interesting traveller's tale. Why do you interview someone who's quite ignorant of Poland, insensitive to the beliefs of the Catholics there, and one whose utterly superficial and banal observations do not do credit to your program? Just as it's wrong to denigrate the worldviews and sufferings of the Australian Indigenous people, do not denigrate the worldviews and sufferings of Polish, Jewish, Catholic, Orthodox or Protestant by interviewing someone who has not got a clue about the country and just profits from vicarious observation and ignorance. Poland's history of dissidence to political correctness might be something you'd like to explore. That would be really daring. All right, thank you, Alicia. We'll take that on board and we love to hear from you. Now, just a very quick mention of By Design this morning, coming up after the news at 9. Philip Cox, one of the most interesting and influential Australian architects, will be in to talk about his practice and his determination that has taken him to the top of his profession, and that really should be in fact, I heard him on Breakfast the other day in a shorter interview, so I'll be looking forward to a longer interview with Philip Cox and By Design after the news this morning at 9. The weather around the country as we come to the end of November is thus. Perth will be fine with a top of 24. Adelaide, a maximum of 21 with a shower or two and clearing. Hobart, showers clearing 14. Melbourne, a few showers and a top of 19. Canberra, showers easing with a chance of a storm 21. Wollongong, a shower and a chance of an afternoon thunderstorm 23. Sydney, a few showers easing 25. Newcastle, a few showers easing 26. Brisbane, thundery rain and clearing late 26. Townsville, a few showers, afternoon thunderstorm 32. Cairns, a shower and a thunderstorm 32. And Darwin, an afternoon storm inland and a top of 33. The meaning of sport, coming up next here on Saturday Extra.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.